Pubcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you have a long-standing grief, the acupuncturist would assume that you've got some kind of a lung issue. The lungs and grief very closely connected. Another way around too. If you had a grief, they would assume that you'd have a. What am I getting these backwards? Yeah, if you have a lung problem, they would assume there's a grief issue. So these things are hardwired.
Welcome to the Liberated Healer Podcast, where we touch on a variety of topics in the world of spirituality, energetic healing, and everything in between and beyond. Take an adventure on a shooting star with your host, Gina, and offering their wisdom, guidance, and everlasting love and support.
Hi, everybody. It is Gina Cavalier, Liberated Healer Podcast. So happy to be with you today, and thank you for joining us and all of your support and liking and sharing, and everybody's been really wonderful. You help us continue to do this every day, and we appreciate you. Today I have Jerry Cantor on. He wrote this book, The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress. So thank you and welcome, Jerry. Nice to have you.
My pleasure, Gina. Thank you for having me.
So this is just a book that's going to have to stay at my bedside for quite a while. There's just so much to get into. So I'd love to try to unpack and inspire people to kind of go more into this direction. So you can tell us a little bit about yourself for a context and about kind of the theme of the book and what got you here or your
primary message. I've had a couple of careers. Before I became a homeopath, I had a long career as an acupuncturist. And Chinese medical theory is very useful in talking about alternative medical ideas, much more effective than conventional medicine, which seems to neglect consciousness, just would prefer to treat the body as if it's just a machine. But in Chinese medicine in particular, in the theory, you know, the mind-body connections are hardwired. So it's not a problem of convincing anybody that, there's a stress element here to your condition. For example, if you went to an acupuncturist and you said you have loose stools, the acupuncturist would automatically assume that you worry too much. And the other way around, if you had loose stools, the acupuncturist would automatically assume that, if you're obsessive and worrying, would assume that you would have some problem with your stools. If you have a longstanding grief, the acupuncturist would assume that you've got some kind of a lung issue. The lungs and grief very closely connected. The other way around too. If you had a grief, they would assume that you'd have a. What am I getting these backwards? Yeah, if you have a lung problem, they would assume there's a grief issue. So these things are hardwired. In homeopathy, it's even more powerful. You cannot find a remedy without knowing the mental and the emotional features of the person that would fit into the application of that remedy. You can't do it. Anyway, I was an acupuncturist for a long, long time. And then, I don't know, I honestly think I was called to homeopathy because I was not at least interested in it at all until I can't even explain what happened. I just woke up and said I had to become one, thinking originally that I would just be attaching remedy selection to my usual acupuncture, and it didn't work out that way at all. It's not a simple attachment. I just started studying it, and I realized I fell in love with Materia Medica, which is the study of the remedies and what they do. And when you do that, you find out to your astonishment that everything is alive. Everything has a consciousness, every substance, every plant, every mineral compound. And these things are discovered by rigorous science. Homeopathic proving involves people under blinded conditions, not knowing what they're taking, on a regular basis, ingesting some kind of substance, not a gross enough amount to do any harm, but in a gross amount, much more than in a homeopathic remedy, which could be a plant, it could be the venom of a spider or a snake, tiny amount that would be enough to produce in a bunch of random people a certain set of very peculiar identifying characteristics. So that's the inverse of the law of similars, which is in homeopathy, which is like cures like. When you're researching a substance, I guess you could call it the law of inculcation, because you're creating the state under research conditions. And, you know, in these volunteers, healthy volunteers, homeopathy is researched on healthy people, not on sick people. So anyway, that information gets transferred to the homeopathic materia medica, which are these textbooks, which are full of this information about that substance, which is what I fell in love with, this particular book. And what I love about the materia medica is how honest it is. It contains not just pathological information, but positive information too. So every substance, and this comes through the provings, has a positive effect and also negative effects. And homeopaths don't care, because anything that leads to the selection of the remedy matters. And I'd contrast that, this is a long answer to your question, but to two other books that we rely on. One is the Physician's Desk Reference, which talks about drugs and sort of likes to assume, you know, poo-poo the side effects of the drug, like they're inconsequential or they're accidental. They're not. They're absolutely a part of what the drug does. And anybody who watches TV and sees all the commercials for the drugs and the long list of terrible conditions underneath that's associated with that would know that. And the other book that bookends the homeopathic materia medica would be a toxicology text, which says, oh, these are all the poisonous effects of this particular substance. Homeopathic remedies are made from substances which are their medicines and their toxins. In a tiny amount, the remedy cures what it would otherwise produce in a healthy individual under research conditions. Anyway, I found that the existential issues that are embedded in the substances, when you really study them, that's what really drew my attention and made me fall in love with homeopathy. And that brings us back to this particular book I've produced now, which is very much about the deep existential issues that are embedded, you know, within each of these substances. And I've organized them in a certain way according to philosophical principles that I've learned. And
yes.
That also implies that chronic illness that these remedies treat are all rooted in existential problems, by which I mean, you know, people use the word existential a lot these days, especially with regard to climate change. Oh, my God, climate's changing. We're all going to die. We're all going to die. And then people describe that as an existential threat. It means more than that. It's not just, oh, my God, we're going to die. It's mean, what's the meaning here? What's the purpose of this? And in my book, I've identified five profoundly existential questions that are the kind of the backbone for all the other, for like subcategories of those questions that all have remedies connected with them.
And we'll get into a few of those, you know, a few of those five just for to get people started. Because this is some, if you have any kind of desire to fall into this, you really do need the book because it's so detail oriented. And it's interesting because I did go to a regular doctor today and you just kind of diagnosed me, which I think is so funny. And, you know, everything always aligns up spiritually at the time that you need it. But I've had a little minor lung thing, just minor, but always like a mild phlegm. And I'm never sick. I haven't been sick. But it's just this phlegm that keeps coming up. And you said that that lung automatically would relate to grief. And I've had a very grief ridden year, intense, a lot of things I'm working through and I'm doing really well with it, but it was very intense grief. So, and, I've had, some back issues as well. And I went into the regular doctor and he didn't even look at me. He says, "You're fine. There's nothing." And he wouldn't even know nothing else. I was like, not even any advice, no guidance, no nothing. So, you know, and I kind of went because I was hoping to get maybe an MRI or an X-ray or something on my back, but I was just like, of course, you know, that's why I always go and talk to people like you, because this is where we all are turning to. This is the real information. We need help. We're not feeling good. We need some answers. And you just don't get them for the most part anymore. So thank you again, because, you know, people need to live a full life as much as possible. And feeling good is such and to have it. When you said that lungs associated with grief, to me, that was I honestly never heard that. Never.
It's funny. So it's also just kind of advanced placement common sense. When you sob, you know, your whole body, you're actually. you would feel it in your lungs, just the act of sobbing. You feel it there. I'll say some other things. You know, conventional medicine is all diagnosis driven. And that's the diagnoses are in large part just labels that are attached to something. You can take the label off, put another one on, and there are fashions and trends in pathology all the time. Homeopathy is not dependent on these diagnoses at all. We'll write them down. We'll, you know, take a, you know, make a note of them. Sometimes there's information attached to that. But in my country, people with the same diagnosis would all get different remedies. And the same remedy could be used for many different kinds of conditions, flipping that around.
Yeah. And you incorporate spirituality into the work that you do. And can you just briefly tell me what you think? I heard you on another podcast talk about Emanuel Swedenborg. And a lot of people know that I have a book coming out from the Swedenborg Foundation. So I was like, oh, he's talking about Swedenborg. Can you just talk about, I call him like my father, because he's helped me. I feel like he was there when I wrote my book.
Wow. Yeah, Swedenborg was a great, great genius. He was a contemporary of Newton's. I fantasized about writing a novel where they met each other or something at some point. I don't think they did, but they surely would have known about each other. What Swedenborg is known for in the homeopathic community in particular is this adage, as above, so below. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
He was just such a genius in every field that he studied. He had many patents in mining. And then he got suddenly very interested in the body, and he decided to find out where the soul was. So he made a detailed study of anatomy, and he couldn't find the soul by looking at the anatomy. So he, on his own, he invented a kind of self-hypnosis, some kind of hypnagogic state, and he would go into these trances. How he invented this, how he figured this out, I don't know. But in those trances, he was just so gifted in so many ways. He became deeply, deeply mystical. And he wrote hundreds of books which detail his explorations in the mystic trance, whereby he apparently, according to him, and his accounts are so detailed, visited heaven and hell and talked to dead people and in great detail. And he was famous for it. It was actually proven out. The Queen of Sweden was really tormented about the death of, I think, a relative of hers. She called Swedenborg to her and asked these questions and asked Swedenborg to interview this dead relative. And Swedenborg said, all right, you know, and he went off and did it and came back with answers that only the queen could have possibly related to. It was unquestionably that he had done this. At a dinner party once, he just got very, very agitated. He was living, the dinner party was hundreds of miles from Stockholm. And he just got very agitated because he said, Stockholm's on fire. Stockholm's on. And that was exactly true at that moment. Just huge powers. So his writings were so extensive and so popular that an entire church, which was created for him. He didn't have any interest in creating a church. This was all within the Christian tradition. And he was just very interested in exploring, really existentially, what the meaning of life was. And okay, let me put it this way. His idea of God, the Godhead, which almost got him excommunicated even within the Christian church, was that it was shaped like a human being. The Godhead was just shaped like the human being. This is something like in Judaism, the Kabbalah, which is also shaped like a human being. And there are angels working in every part of that shape. And they all have specific jobs. So here's where the above, as above, so below plays out. If you have a problem with your spleen on earth, what Swedenborg would do, he would go and you wanted to know about it. You would go and talk to the angels who are working in the spleen up there, and you would find out what their spiritual purpose was. Mm-hmm. And that was so knowing what happened above would have implications for what's going on down below. And this is kind of at the core of homeopathic thinking, which is spiritual forensics. It's not enough to know what the symptoms are and what's going on physically. They have, as I keep making this point over and over again, they have a spiritual issue. There's something that the angels could explain to you what is going wrong there, if you follow this kind of reasoning. And there's a lot more to it, but there were so many books he wrote, and they're just absolutely spectacular because they're written in a little bit of an archaic language. But I don't have to sell it to you, speaking to the choir. He's just an amazing writer and thinker. And he had a huge influence on the transcendentalist movement in the United States. And homeopathy was a really big part of that. So he's considered the spiritual godfather of homeopathy.
Thank you for that. I've never heard it put so simply about that side of him. And it can get a lot really convoluted because the text is so in so many different directions. So I really appreciate that.
Sometimes I go back and read his books, which are compilations of his books. So if you can't read everything he wrote, there'll be somebody who says, I'm just going to study Swedenborg from the point of view of his understanding of physiology. So I can look in that book and see what he thought the angels of the lungs were doing, some parts of that human, that being was so special and sacred that he didn't have access to them, like the part of the being that related to reproduction. That was almost off grounds to him. He said he's very honest about it.
Yeah. I actually, in my youth, when I was about 19, I was having a bad time, and I was actually a heavy suicidal ideation point in my life. And I was in a coffee shop and I saw a book that said Conversations by Angels, and I felt like it was talking to me. And it was just one of those free books, and I sat down, and it just, like, for that moment really just took me out of that space. And so when the publisher asked me, why do you want to be with Swedenborg Foundation, I told him that story. It's a part of the whole, in my book, we talk about this. It's like, you have to eat well. It's the people you're around. It's the place that you live. It's, all that stuff. That's exactly, what you're expressing to people. What about, so chronic illnesses, obviously, also I had chronic fatigue syndrome for about 20 years and I got rid of it. And it definitely was a part spiritually, I got rid of it. So I think that's very interesting. Do you have any insight into something like chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia?
Again, it's not, homeopathy is not diagnosis driven, but I can talk about some things, some remedies in relationship to that, to give you an idea of how much fun it is to do the homeopathy part. So one famous remedy for prostration, we use old language, exhaustion, just can't get yourself out of bed, having to make a huge effort, would be the remedy Carbo Vegetabilis. So what is Carbo Vegetabilis? It is vegetable charcoal. Now let's think about that for a moment. You have to imagine, this is again kind of fun, but it's advanced placement common sense. If you're a piece of vegetable charcoal, you have like just a little bit of oxidative material left in there that can burn. You're almost completely burnt out. You're burnt out, but there's a little bit left there. And you can oxidize the rest of that by blowing on it, lighting it and blowing on it, right? A little bit less of it will glow. So how does that pertain to somebody in this state of exhaustion? Not everybody's in this, but it would pertain to somebody who, often this would be a case after someone has recovered from a very debilitating illness, might need this remedy Carbo Vegetabilis. And here the interesting, peculiar keynotes of that, that go well beyond the diagnosis. They would be chilled. They would be cold. They would like a completely burnt out, almost completely burnt out piece of charcoal. But they would like it when like a little breeze is put on them, like the fan is on them. So they'll tell you, "Yeah, I'm cold, but I love it when there's a little breeze on me." And that's the feeling of that little breeze promoting the glow in the charcoal. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's you really enter the consciousness of that particular substance in order to apply that remedy, and you can't do it otherwise. It's not like prostration disease. Take this. You kind of have to understand the feeling behind that. But there are other remedies where people are profoundly tired for completely different reasons. They have no oomph for colloquial expressions might be useful, like just someone's lost their mojo. Like someone who's normally very active, loves exercise, disappointment and resentment could be just pull them down, and they kind of go down fighting like everything is half-hearted. And that would be a remedy like sepia, which is made from the ink of the cuttlefish. And women often need that when their marriages go sour, but they still like to dance. They're natural women, but they feel like they don't know where they are in life, and they just get flattened out and apathetic. It's a very important remedy for women. And the existential issue in there that I would boil the whole thing down to is the idea that hope has become toxic. These are people who are normally very hopeful, and they cannot give up their hope completely. That would be impossible. But the psyche tries to have it both ways. They're optimistic, but they find that every time they hope, they kind of get bitten in the rear end, so they have to stagnate. Produces a state of extreme stagnation in them. And it says, like the psyche says, okay, I'm stagnating, everything's okay, it seems to be working. Oh, damn, I hoped. And now you've got to start it all over again. So that's again, two remedies that can speak to exhaustion, but they're very different themes. The Carbovegetabilis does not have this mental and emotional picture, but the sepia does.
Since you were talking about hope and we were talking about suicidal ideation, maybe we could talk about a little bit of that. But now that you see that, now that you were saying like you have that hope, then you have that little bit of you're feeling great. And then something else happened just at the moment where you're feeling good and it brings you back down. And that's emotional cycle.
Yeah, that's a dynamic. So, that's that particular dynamic. You get ensnared in that. And then the remedy actually cures you of that. People who've gone through sepia, I'll say more about sepia in terms of the theme, because it's so much fun to learn this. That's the ink of the cuttlefish, right? Cuttlefish is a very smart fish, and its trick is to squirt ink into the water when it's attacked. So now the attacker can't see the fish, but the cuttlefish doesn't know where it is either. So the metaphor is the waters are muddied. The waters are muddied. I don't know where I am. So one of the ways I identify sepia as a remedy is I'll ask the woman, tell me something. Where are you in life? And I'll get a response. I don't know. I mean, it's very unclear. So like if you go from, with women, it's much more defined than with men, going when your identity is attached to your sexual identity. For women, the first period is a much bigger deal than for men. First sexual experience, being pregnant, men have nothing like that. Menopause, being married. So if those changes are not negotiated well, if there's a problem in your life at that point, sepia is one of the remedy states that can come out. You just don't know where you are in life. What? Where'd my slim, sexy body go? I'm swollen like a pumpkin. This is ridiculous. Who am I? You know, in menopause, I'm what? Within a flash, I go from being a reproductive woman to being barren? Are you kidding me? So it can be confusing. And this is reflected by the materia medica of the remedy sepia.
And wow, it's, I'm just getting flashes. I don't know where they're coming from, but basically where a lot of this information was probably carnal knowledge in our ancestors, and that, where did that big, that giant chunk of time where we've lost all this history, and what you've been doing is going back and getting this ancestral carnal knowledge that, we would probably, my mother would have taught me, when you get older and this happens to you, you'll do this, or you'll need this, And you have these remedies. And so basically I feel like you're collecting this information again and kind of providing it, like we're going back into this type of, natural life.
You may not have to go back that far in time. I mean, the knowledge about botanical medicine is very, very old. I mean, among indigenous people, goes way, way back. But homeopathy, all the remedies have different histories. But going back to sepia again, my understanding of how that remedy was discovered was that a homeopath was sent to the home of a painter who had who was very stagnated and depressed and didn't quite know where he was. And the homeopath noticed that when he was painting, he would dip his brush into a substance and put it on his mouth. What was that substance? That was, they were using sepia, the color sepia. He was using sepia as a color. And the homeopath said, well, that would be something worth researching. And that's kind of how that happened. And that wasn't that so long ago. I mean, that was a couple of hundred years ago, not that ancient kind of knowledge. But we have provings both of that are deliberate. As I say, we have real research with subjects and accidental provings as well from poisonings. One of the most famous stories of this is the remedy Lachesis, which is made from the venom of the Brazilian Bushmaster snake. Again, we get make powerful medicines from really nasty stuff. And in the 1900s, when homeopathy was very well known, was quite prominent, it was front page news on the New York Times when Constantine Hering, this famous homeopath, voyaged to Brazil looking for the most deadly snake he could find because he knew it would become a good remedy. Okay, he found that snake. It was the Brazilian Bushmaster, and he was playing around with it, and either it bit him or he exposed himself to the venom, and he was very, very close to death, ranting and on his deathbed. His wife was with him and wrote down everything that he'd said, and also how he appeared, what his gestures were, and he was rambling, talking tremendously fast, and this, he survived it. But this is the absolute core of the Lachesis remedy. If somebody comes and they can't stop talking, maybe I'm in that state now.
I love it.
But if there's a compulsiveness to that they're talking, like a steam kettle letting off steam, and all the other symptoms fit into it, that's the remedy that you would think of. Also, the people who need Lachesis have lots of throat issues. They have problems with swallowing. They don't want anything tight around their neck. And metaphorically, that relates to a snake too, because a snake is all neck, right? And there's a lot of things like that. But I mean, that was one way that substance was researched. Fortunately, he survived it. But sometimes we get information from somebody who doesn't even survive. But we'd much rather research it on healthy individuals in a manageable amount.
And so, if this is a road you want to go down, I mean, there's not a lot of you out there. There's your book, which is a great way. But, you know, when you're looking for support, what do you tell people? Are there more people getting into this? Or is it traditional? The acupuncturist is also going to have some of this information?
Well, Gina, 500 million people around the world use homeopathy. It's not a mystery. And I'm not the only homeopath. Believe me, I'm not. And this country has a very peculiar history because it's been attacked so ferociously by the medical profession. And that's because it's such a worthwhile rival and it's superior in so many ways. I will tell you, if I'm hit by a car and I need surgery, I'll absolutely go and get surgery, go to the doctor. You know, yes. There's various things. And I love nursing. There are many aspects of conventional medicine I really value. But on the whole, homeopathy really is superior to pharmaceutical medicine, really, almost entirely. I have to say that. It's not that it is. My goodness. I mean, there are hundreds of homeopathic medical schools in India. It is central to the practice in Switzerland, covered by their healthcare system. Until it was recently attacked so ferociously in England, it was absolutely central to the public health system. The Royal London Homeopathic Hospital still stands, and it's a tourist attraction in London. The Royal Family of England has used it for many, many years. If you go to South America or many, many places, Central America, you will see homeopathic pharmacies everywhere. It will not go away, even though its truth is inconvenient to the medical profession. The remedies are not patented. They do not cause side effects. They cause aggravation effects, which is the body's trying to throw something off, but that is not a side effect. Side effect of a medicine is the body saying, gee, give me a break. I can't assimilate this. I can't accommodate this. You're making me worse. I can't stand it. And then the doctor has to make this very heavy assumption. In my opinion, the good outweighs the bad. Take it again, take it again. And we get into a lot of trouble with that. Homeopathy is really, I sounds so controversial to say this, but actually superior in many ways to conventional medication. It's slower and it's more honest because it prompts the body to heal on its own. It's not prompting. It's not like a bulldozer that's running you over.
I was really lucky when I first moved in 1987, when I was 17, I met a doctor, Dr. Plants, and he was both. And so he would always try other remedies before he would try the other. And he was so rare and he would teach me about different things, you know, why don't you go try black walnut or, you know, and little things like that or to do different stuff. And so I really appreciated that. But he has had serious repercussions in the medical industry because of that. They've actually come after him for that. So, but in the US, when I go to Europe, like in France, they do have the different homeopathic stuff. There in Europe, it is definitely more prevalent to go ahead and try these different things. But in the US, especially when you're young, you literally are taught just to go to the doctor for everything. Like it is.
Yeah, Gina, there was an era called the era of the non-consultation clause. Just to give you an idea of how serious the antipathy is, the rivalry and the bitterness, where the doctor said, even if a physician spoke to a homeopath, he'd lose his license. And it happened that even there would be physicians who were married to a homeopath, and they would have a conversation, they'd lose their license. That's how vicious it was. So it's no accident. There's not a lot of love lost, and it's not because homeopathy doesn't work. It's because in the 1800s, homeopaths were rich. Everybody preferred going to them, and the medical profession said, "This can't be. They're eating our lunch. We have to stop this." And that's the campaign became so political. There's no reason why, if you really care about the well-being of a client, why you would not look at everything, on an equal playing field. What's best for my client? You wouldn't attach yourself to some dogma and just give something because a pharmaceutical company needs to make money on it. You wouldn't ban a whole kind of class of medicine or attack it because it was effective because you were having a hard time making a living. That's spiritually incorrect. I don't think that you'd argue with me about that.
No, and I actually worked for a law firm for a while doing mass torts, and we were doing, campaigns against pharmaceutical companies for really crazy things, like an antidepressant that they had handed out to all the prisoners who ever wanted it in prison, and in the male prisons, and they were developing female breasts from the actual medication. And they literally had to go have mastectomies. It was terrible. And so they had these lawsuits, but the company puts aside, they know they're going to get sued. So they just, that's just in their budget.
And they constantly break the law. And you're right. They put money aside. They're actually in many ways a criminal organization, criminals. And I'm not just saying that. They're constantly being constantly in court and defending themselves, paying huge amounts out, but they make so much money that they can afford it. It is part of the business practice. And that also includes, of course, attacking people who give them any kind of a hard time. This is not so different from how the mafia works.
Absolutely. So I feel like bringing it into light is actually helping. And it was sad because the lawyers would really give people hope. And at the end of the days, the lawyers were getting the most of the money. And so at the end of the day, the person was still losing. So hopefully when you can turn to this and start to get more education and finding these different ways, what are some of the other things, interesting stories that you have for us today?
You're talking about suicidality. I mean, that I could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, please.
But I have a couple of, I've got so many stories. There's a few interesting case histories in there. I do analyses of some well-known figures like Phil Connors from the Groundhog Day movie, What His Remedy Might Be, and also some Greek myths, Sisyphus, for example, and very I analyze Hamlet from Shakespeare, what his existential problem is. But I'll go back to a suicidality. And by the way, of course, Hamlet is famous for having said, to be or not to be, this famous suicidal question. He was just monkeying around. He didn't really mean it. I'm going to describe two very significant suicide remedies in homeopathy. And you won't make any mistake. You cannot possibly mistake one for the other once you know of it. Ever read in the paper that so-and-so killed himself? And you say, well, who, him? He was the valedictorian of his class. Everybody loved him. He wound up being a CEO of this company. He was a leader in the church, just hugely responsible, capable person. Him, of all people? This is the remedy Aurum, which is made from gold. Okay? People who need that remedy, they're as good as gold. Language is very useful. They were up there living their lives at the very peak. They live their lives for God, for the highest possible purpose. So what's wrong with that? And why does that predispose you to suicide? Because they put everything on their shoulders. They carry everything themselves. That's their go-to mode. Now, what if that go-to mode exhausts you? What if you take on too much? What if you're so invested in doing everything right, and someone criticizes you and you're exhausted. There's no place else to go. Boom. No place else. They don't have a step-down mechanism. Now, I've given Gorham many times to people who are not suicidal, but that same idea is there. I'm living for God, and I take everything on my shoulders. I'll give you something from the Bible, which I think is very interesting. So in Exodus, Moses, this is, of course, it's, everybody knows this story, is angry at the Jews for worshiping the golden calf. Right? What's that all about? They're not living for God. They're living for idols. They're living for materialism. And what Moses does, and a colleague of mine has been researching Moses within the Egyptian tradition and has discovered that Moses was a physician and a shaman. I said when Moses melted down the gold and he fed it to the Israelites, he was actually performing homeopathic research. He was doing exactly what happens in a homeopathic proving. So I don't know how he knew that, but he did. As I say, gold as a homeopathic remedy, well, he was not doing giving it as a remedy. He was doing the proving aspect of it. They needed to consume the gold so that they could live for a higher purpose. So metaphysically or shamanically, that's why Moses fed that to the Israelites, so that they would get the feeling of gold and live for a higher purpose. In a tiny amount, it would be the opposite of firm. Would be the opposite situation. Somebody is prone to being suicidal because he or she lives too much for God and is too responsible, and therefore the remedy in a dilute amount would help them to live a little bit more balanced. It has a huge impact on the heart. And again, language is useful. We say our heart is heavy, or this has touched my heart. Aurum is also a tremendous grief remedy, not so much for its impact on the lungs, but for the heart. This has touched my heart. People who take things to heart. And that's why they're attracted to listening to classical music and to praying. All these things pertain to that Aurum picture. Now, the other remedy, which is for suicidality, very prominent, is very different. And that is Natrum Sulfurica, sometimes called Glauber Salt. Now, this is a person who's not living for the highest purpose, not for a bad purpose either, but if somebody who in their life has been too many times been treated like he or she doesn't count. They just don't count. It's a grief remedy. That is a grief remedy. They're treated, they're discounted. And they brood over this, and they will likely to have loose stools, be very sensitive to dampness. Their relationship to music will be interesting too. They'll be kind of melancholy people, and they'll listen to music and get very sad over it. On the other hand, they'll also be very objective. They'll be drawn to facts. Anyway, this kind of person, why does this person become suicidal? Because when her buttons are pushed and she feels one more time that she's being treated like she's not listened to, doesn't count, the psyche says, gee, it's like I'm not even here. Who would even care? I mean, what's the point? You know, and that in that mindset, they would be prone to hanging themselves, something like that.
That's my dog, probably.
So there's two different suicidality remedies. There are other ones also, but those are the two most interesting ones where the picture is clearest. And people who commit suicide for two entirely different reasons. And those remedies would be very useful. J. Anthony Lucas, who wrote Common Ground, you know this story?
No.
Very famous book. No one should move to the Boston area without reading Common Ground. It was a whole series of... a whole long series of TV programs about it. It had to do with the busing crisis in Boston in the 70s. He was one of these people who had put everything on his shoulder, just, you know, work was very, very dedicated, wrote this fantastic book. He got all kinds of prizes for it. Now, later on in his life, he wrote a book called Big Trouble, which was like a 600-page book about a labor crisis in Minnesota. And he was being interviewed. I think he was in a completely exhausted state. And he was being interviewed, and someone asked him a question that questioned the premise of the book. And Lucas sort of was stunned, and he went home and killed himself.
Oh.
That's that kind of person. Later on, the book won all kinds of awards. But in my opinion, a remedy like Aurum would have saved his life if he had taken that. This would not have happened to him.
So Aurum is O-R-E-M?
No, A-U-R-U-M. A-U-R, Aurum. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know it. I was trying to look it up and I couldn't.
It's on the periodic. That's the AU is the symbol on the periodic table for gold.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you went, I can't, are you muted?
Oh, sorry.
Okay, now I can hear you, yeah.
What was the second remedy you were talking about?
The second remedy is Natrum Sulfuricum.
Okay.
Natrum Sulphicum. And please don't, I don't want any listener to go and take these remedies just because I talked about them. If you're going to take a remedy, absolutely see a homeopath. Don't mess around with that because the high potencies, you will not understand your response. It will kick something up in the beginning because a remedy tricks your vital force into converting a problem into a chronic problem into something like an acute problem. So you're going from a chronic problem, which is very useful to the pharmaceutical profession. you've got good days and bad days, but you're always stuck there. And an acute problem, the benefit of that is that you actually get to the other side of it. You have the vital force identifies a problem, could be a pathogen or an emotional insult, makes a big deal out of it, and then fights it off. That's like a sine curve, right?
Yeah.
And that's the opposite of how society looks at illness now. We are terrified of acute illness. Everybody's scared out of their pants about it, but they're very at home with chronic illness because there's so many medicines that can sedate you or, you know, suppress your symptoms for that. Homeopaths have completely the opposite idea. We'd rather you utilize the doctor inside yourself, which is your immune system and your vital force, engage with something genuinely, and fight it off. This is the, again, advanced placement common sense, the idea that, you know, face your demons rather than escape them.
Yes.
And you're so, supposed to live. Your point in being alive is to live fully, as you said many times yourself. You know, we're not meant to just be sedated and sipping pina coladas on the beach all day. We are meant to learn things in this life and engage with our problems and process our karma.
Yeah, I commented in somebody's post yesterday. I was, if we got the answers to the test, you know, in life, what would be the point? You know, so it's
very good.
You do have to do that thing. And again, I'll just remind everybody, yes, this is the reason why we're actually even highlighting this. Get the book if you know, as well, The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, and then have that name in your head and see if it seems right to you, and then go to the homeopath and ask them what they think after looking at you wholly. So just again, don't go out and do it yourself. And we're going to put some disclaimers on, you know, on here, but that's just so you guys know, again, as Jerry mentioned, go to a homeopath. And what I really love about this though, is how often does a person who says, I feel like I'm suicidal, I'm going to go to a homeopathic doctor. This is really great information because number one, a lot of people who have suicidal ideation is a complete secret. You know, it's more acceptable to be a drug addict or an alcoholic or anything than to be suicidal, you know? So it is a completely hidden, pain that a lot of people have. And if you can, you know, when you, and there's such a huge fear to go to a full Western doctor about it too, you automatically think you're going to be in a 50-150 hold, even if you tell somebody, because they don't know what to do. So this is a great, helpful thing to go to a homeopathic doctor who you can feel more safe with. You can do, you know, there's this huge fear. They're going to put me on this medicine. I'm not going to be able to be creative or make love to my wife.
Back to my examples, if you're in an Aurum state and you take everything as your own responsibility, it will not occur to you that someone else can help you. It will not occur to you. You're just going to say, this is my problem. I've got to solve this myself, and you'll exhaust yourself. So more, it may often be the case that someone else has to bring someone like that. Or the Natrum Sulfuricum state, someone just says, well, why would I deserve any help? I'm hardly here at all. You know, then it's not going to be like, you have to have a little bit of a grain of health to say, ask for help for someone else. You know,
yeah.
But there, in any case, yeah, you don't even need to read the book to see a homeopath. You would, if the job of a homeopath is to deconstruct your condition, to make an interview, figure out what the meaning of what you're saying is, and also what you're not saying. The body talks. The body's symptoms, as I in some of the examples I gave before, are an expression. The body revealing what the inner message is. I have this adage that acute illness detoxifies us, but chronic illness informs. If the chronic illness symptoms can be interpreted, then the homeopath can prescribe for it. And the additional benefit of that is demystifying what has happened to you. you know, the mystery, people being so fearful of their illnesses and being so, having been, you know, bought this idea that you're not going to know what's going on with your body. You do not have a right to know about it. There are tests that can be taken, but of course they're inconclusive. We have lost agency for our health. And we are meant to learn from everything, of course, not just illness. But illness is a great, great teacher. And the idea is not to leave you in it just because it's the great teacher, but to see what is pushing us to change, and so that we can grow and evolve as spiritual beings.
So you must find, when you are out in nature, do you do any nature walks and just kind of look at for, I mean, you must be fascinated by every living thing around you.
I love forest bathing. I love my hiking mountains. It's not just homeopathy. It's being part of nature, being respectful of nature, becoming part of it as much as possible, being humble. It's hard these days. We are such electronic environments, digital environments. We live in, there's so much, just our workspaces, our life spaces. There's not a lot of green around us. We have to make an effort to go to that. People flourish on vacations when they go to the mountains or go to the lakes. I know I do. There's many things that if you go into the mountains and into the forest and you realize, my God, I feel really good here. You look around, it's not an accident. You know, you're among very vibrant kindred spirits that we need to retain a connection with. The soil, the earth, you know, the trees, the mountains, the sky, the air.
And a lot of people are finally talking about this, but now a new word, they were calling it grounding, but now it's earthing. So the idea also is that, for example, if you were to take like live dill or live fennel or whatever and grind it up, like it has picked in its, you know, out of its natural source has like a consciousness, that element.
Yes, everything does. So we find this out in the provings. We find this; those are extremely interesting things to participate in. If you took a substance over a period of time, and no one told you what it was, and you kept a journal and you wrote down all kinds of things, you would the person who organizes the proving would collate all those strange symptoms out, and then there'd be a big discussion of them, and the bit by bit the issue would come out, the existential issue there, that is actually part of the consciousness of that substance, That's supposedly science has moved away from this kind of metaphysical thinking. This is the line that we're taught left and right in our schools. Science does not do that. Science is totally objective. We just rely totally on quantitative measures and so forth. There's a lot lost with that. We absolutely can enter into the consciousness of other materials and substrates, and the entire table the periodic table of elements has been interpreted from the themes of the individual elements, which is why they often have the names of Greek gods, and the myths that attach to those Greek gods are actually played out in the table of periodic elements. I can tell you stories about that. It's the sort of thing I fell in love with, which is absolutely fascinating. Do you have time for one? Want to hear one?
Yeah, go for it. Tell me your best one.
Well, I'll give you one. Okay. So there's a remedy, there's an element on the periodic table called polonium. Okay. Polonium was discovered by Marie Curie, who was famous for having found radium. And she's a Polish woman, and she was in France, looking at these substances and analyzing them. And there's a substance there that she encountered, and she didn't know what it was, and she started studying it. And as she's studying it, she was very, very nostalgic for Poland, and she named it polonium, based on the state of mind that she was in. So this is also the realm where the synchronicities play out a lot. But let me unpack this for you even further. So she was very nostalgic when she discovered polonium, and she attached that name to it. She wanted to be back in Poland. Well, completely separate from that, when people did a proving of polonium, again, giving people healthy individuals a certain amount of it, not enough to poison them, but just enough to bring out a picture. Guess what happened?
What?
They became highly nostalgic. They became very, very, you know, they became much more interested in the past. They got very nostalgic for the past. So that actually came through the provings, and it was blinded. Now, beyond that, polonium is also used in the preservation of old movies. It preserves the past. Now, get this. Listen to this. Do you remember when this Russian expatriate from was poisoned in London? I forget his name. His long Russian name is a. He was. A couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, he was poisoned in London.
Yes.
He was poisoned by the KGB.
Yep.
It's incontrovertible. The poison that was used was polonium. Now, what does that mean? Okay, first of all, it's not like rat poison. You can't get polonium easily. That's a very, very difficult substance to get. You have to go to quite a long length to obtain that. Why would the Russians choose polonium to poison this guy? And my theory is they're saying, this is a message that says, hey, you think you're free. You think that the KGB are a bunch of dinosaurs from the past, right? Uh-huh. That what you think? You're going to get polonium. This is going to remind you and everybody that the past is alive. It's a kind of nostalgia. It's poisonous nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
The remedy the movie that I attach to this remedy, which I anytime I want to teach it, is this fantastic film called Sunset Boulevard. I don't know if you know that. So the actress who's been very faded from the silent movie era, she lives totally for nostalgia. She lives in a dilapidated mansion, watching her old movies over and over again, you know. And she lures someone into her lair there, and it winds up destroying him. But that movie, Sunset Boulevard, really very perfectly embodies the idea of polonium from the point of view of nostalgia and the preservation of the past. These are synchronicities that homeopaths get live with every day. Very peculiar things happen, connecting things that don't seem like they're connected. But within the field of energy, it's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence energetically that Marie Curie was nostalgic when she happened to identify by that. She was in touch with it in some way, and it was not a random selection. And the fact that she could not possibly have known that it would be used to preserve movies, she couldn't possibly have known that. So it's a very interesting kind of a thing, how this happens. And all various elements on the periodic table, they're represented by their name for Greek mythical characters whose story likewise is attached to the meaning of the element and its use in homeopathy.
And that was in 2006, the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko.
You found it. That's right. That's right. You can look it up. Yeah, he was poisoned by polonium. Yeah. And I think I'm probably the only individual outside the homeopathic community who's wondered why that, you know, come up with that explanation and why polonium was chosen. And it was not done consciously by the Russians. I think so at a subconscious level, that's what they were trying to do. I don't think it was a conscious choice.
No, but that was horrific. That was very scary. And I think he's still in prison. They have him in prison now. And but you know, okay. That's all really. One last thing. I know, you know what, we're in this age of wanting to not age, you know? And I tell a lot of people that, and in my opinion, that, you know, if you balance all these things out and you, including the spiritual part of you, or if it's just energy, say if you don't even want to, you don't believe in spirituality or soul, you don't have to, it could be just energy. But I feel like when you're missing the energetic part of yourself or working on the energetic part of yourself and just trying to, you know, do the de-aging stuff that we do, the regular stuff, like you're missing the whole point. Do you have any kind of context about, you know, this keeping this youthful energy or vibrancy?
Yeah. Okay. I'll try something. I mean, basically, we're all going to age and die, and it's absolutely necessary that we go through those stages. The question is not, you know, not to fear any of these one particular things. So I'm going to sort of pull rank here and discuss a remedy for where that's a disproportionate value. So the remedy arsenicum, made from arsenic, right? Arsenic, oh, terrible stuff. We're going to make medicine out of arsenic. It's one of our go-to remedies. And arsenic is used as a preservative in lots of foods, actually. So the polarity there, arsenic is all over the place. It's both a preservative and a tissue destroyer. Now, as a homeopathic remedy, when someone needs arsenic, they are really worried about death. They really feel like they don't have much time. They're getting old, and there's very little margin for error. These are perfectionist people who... Now, look, if you actually are poisoned by genuine arsenic, what happens is you get what's called the presentiment of death. It's coming, and your circulation contracts within your body, your extremities get cold, but there's usually some kind of a burning sensation inside. But the feeling is, I don't have much time, there's little margin for error, I've got to get my affairs in order. So people like that, they're very worried about their own death, but also that of the security of their circle of love, their relatives. Is everything going to be okay for who's left behind? There's not much time. I'm getting old. I mean, you don't have to be poisoned by arsenic to feel this way. This is a remedy state that comes out as it's expressed as perfectionism. I will tell you a funny story about this. One of my favorite stories.
Wait, you mentioned it was another word that it cut out before you said arsenic. Was there a word for it?
Yeah, the feeling when you need arsenic, arsenicum, the remedy made from arsenic. Then this is for people who are highly, highly anxious because they're terrified of making a mistake. But the reason they're like that is because they feel there's not much time and they're unusually sensitive to issues around aging. So this is not everybody. This is what's called the homeopathic delusion. Now, the good thing about someone who needs that remedy is that they would make fantastic project supervisors. If I had something that I needed to trust to someone else to get it done, I would love somebody who was an arsenicum personality to take over, to take responsibility for that, because their sense of responsibility, they know they can't, there's no margin for error. And my funny story about that is this. I was asked to give a presentation at a psychotherapy office once, and I was late to get there. And I somehow, it was a lunchtime presentation. And I said, what's the big deal here? A few people there. I was stuck in traffic. I got there late. When I got to this office, to my astonishment, there were 30 people in there, all sitting there with their arms crossed, really annoyed because they're going to get CEUs or something for this presentation. And I was late, and then they couldn't eat their lunch. They were pretty mad at me. Well, somewhat like that. Anyway, I said, oh my gosh. So I decided to talk about anxiety because that would be the sort of thing that come up a lot in a psychotherapeutic practice. So I described this remedy. As I say, just all the things I said to you. Then I said, it has an affinity for a certain hairstyle that I have noticed. When it's women, they tend to have it's someone with a page boy haircut that looks like a helmet. Ever see that, like that page boy hairstyle?
Yeah.
It would be a brunette. Okay. Homeopathy is politically incorrect. We go by appearances. Everything is grist for our mill. And I was saying that how I would like to have an assistant who was who needed this remedy. Of course, I'd give the remedy, but I would know that this person would go to any length to get the thing done. So I looked through the room and I said, yeah, so this would be the kind of person you'd want as your office manager. So I looked through the room and in the way in the back of the room, there was a woman standing there who had this page boy haircut. And as I'm talking about what my fantasy for an office manager would be, I said, it would look like someone like that.
Oh my goodness.
And yes, it's true. I identified the office manager.
Okay. Wow. Interesting.
So from that point on, everything, I had them in the palm of my hand. It went very, very well and I got a lot of clients out of it. So, but why that is, I mean, the helmet actually, it's not random. It's like, I can get it done. I'm going to go into this, like I've got a helmet on. I'm going to go and do that. That's the positive side of it. On the negative side, someone like that would be prone to having all kinds of digestive problems, skin problems, circulatory problems. They could also, another exhaustion remedy, by the way, going back to what we talked about earlier, that state can be very exhausting. And the feeling at the existential level is not much time. I'm going to die. Will everybody around me be okay? But they sublimate that. They turn it into something good, to use Freud's language, by making everything done perfectly. If I get everything done perfectly, then there will be enough time. Everything will get done.
Oh. Yes, people that love to get things done. That's me. Do you want to take us out with any final comments?
My final comments? People should learn to value their illness in the sense that it's worth exploring what it's about. We should not be so prone to fear that we lose perspective and lose control of our lives and lose a sense of why we are alive. Homeopathy is magnificent in that it's a tool that allows us to explore what's going on with us. I do recommend my book for giving you a flavor of that. There are five core existential questions in that book, and we don't have time to go into it. The remedies are then represent the, you know, subcategories of those five questions. Everybody will relate to them. It's not so esoteric that nobody will understand it. There are lots of anecdotes in there and stories and case histories. But I'd like people not to be so fearful and recognize the extent, how much fear works against them, and you know how well it works for the economic machine. That's not, you know, that's good for economics, but we are responsible for our lives, for our bodies, for our spiritual development, for our evolution. And I urge people to take that seriously, because you don't want to live a worthless life. Actually, one of my existential questions was at the very last one, which I relate to what the cancer miasm is this one. The insurrection of my birth worthwhile? So from that standpoint, everybody's birth is an insurrection against the status quo. The world's going along fine, now you come along. And the world has to accommodate you, and you have to have an impact. Now, only at some points in our life do we take that question seriously. The founder of homeopathy, Samuel Hahnemann, has a statue in Washington, D.C., and in Latin on that statue, and he lived there to quite an old age, it says, "My life, I did not live in vain." That question mattered to him very, very much. Frankly, it matters to me too. I'd like to, you know, I'm not going to be sitting on the beach sipping pina coladas my whole life. I want to get something done, and stuff that only I can get done. But everybody has that issue. Again, your birth is an insurrection against the status quo, and everybody has to actually have an insurrection. If you overadapt to the needs of others and you only live for other people's needs for you, you will not become a fully mature human being. So that existential question is they're all five of them are important, but that's the one I would like to leave you with. Feel free to look to explore the meaning of your life.
Mm-hmm. Learn from it. And also, for yourself is not good either. There's a balance. So it's
yeah, yeah. You will get sick if you do not come to terms with this existential question. They do not have yes or no answers. Existential questions do not have yes or no answers, but they have a powerful charge. And in the arsenicum example, the feeling is, my God, I'm going to die. There's not much time. Now, I can't tell you you're not going to die. There's no yes or no answer to that, but it still has a charge that a remedy like arsenicum can dissolve. So when you graduate from that remedy, you say, what was that all about? Yeah, I know I'm going to die, but I mean, yeah, there's plenty of time. It's very different. Mm. It's very different and very helpful to make for the soul, for the vital force to have gone through that kind of transformation. And on top of that, you get a perspective. You say, gee, I wonder what was that all about? How come, what was that all about? That's interesting. So what's the truth about life? That there's not much time or that there is time? I mean, it will prompt some philosophical thinking maybe, but that's okay. We are all philosophers, actually. We're meant to think about why we're alive.
We're meant to think. That's a great way to think about it. You guys, it's been a great hour with you, Jerry. I appreciate you so much. This has been a lot of fun, really informative. You know, we just love to get these great stories. You've collected all this information. It's, you know, we appreciate that you're sharing it with us. Everybody, I'm going to link as much as possible from what we talked about that I can find in here. So many fascinating stories. Please reach out to me if you need any clarification. And again, go get a homeopathic doctor or someone to help you answer these questions. Don't do it on your own. Be careful. A little bit of disclaimer there. But thank you so much. Thank you, Jerry. And it's been a great hour. And we appreciate you guys. Thank you. It's been a liberated healer.
Great pleasure to be here, Gina. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can find us online at theliberatedhealer.com, on Instagram at Liberated Healer Podcast, or on Facebook at The Liberated Healer. Give us a follow, subscribe, send us a message if you so feel, and thank you for your support. Podcast.